We've got this down for public hearing and possible work session on Senate Bill 279. We heard the testimony on this last, and we have dash one amendments. Let me have, are you going to introduce this one?
Mr. Chair, 279 is, when you heard before, it does have some amendments on that, which would change the bill from one of granting the Tax Service Examiner Board authority to determine its fees by rule. It would keep those in statute and raise them by the amount that is built into the budget, which is going through the Ways and Means process.
Okay. So the dash one amendments correspond to the budget that is out on the floor awaiting passage by the House.
Correct.
Okay. We heard testimony on this last time, but I see we got some other, some folks signed up. If we can be brief about this, unless there's something new, let's bring up Pam Constantopoulos and Donna Gilmore and Gerald Zielinski. If you want, the three of you want to come up together. That's fine. Come on forward.
Yes.
All right. Pam, do you want to go first?
Chair Shetterly, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Pamela Constantopoulos. I'm the director of the Oregon State Board of Tax Service Examiners. The testimony that I have is coming around to you now. To supplement my previous testimony, I'd like to enter into the legislative record a couple of items. First of all, in public testimony during the last hearing on this bill, it was said that the long arm of the IRS was sufficient to protect consumers in the tax preparation realm. I'd like to enter into the record a letter from Bob Wenzel, Deputy Commissioner of the Internal Revenue Service, dated March 27, 2001, today. In this letter, he strongly recommends against any proposal to abolish this board and emphasizes that the IRS does not have jurisdiction over tax preparation matters. Secondly, in testimony during the last hearing on this bill, allegations were made that the Oregon that Oregon does not benefit from the license law. We have been in the process of compiling data that demonstrates the benefit of the law. We've made inquiries of several states. So far, one of those states has responded. Jill Yamasaki of the Hawaii Office Audit Branch has informed us via email yesterday that their department processed 952,000 returns, tax-related documents, and had an error rate of 12.7%. According to the Internal Revenue Service, Oregon's audit rates for federal tax returns during the same tax year was 1.9%. It's a dramatic difference, and the difference, we believe, is thanks to Oregon's licensing law. And finally, at the request of Chair Shetterly, I've submitted possible amendments to the bill that would merely increase the statutory level of our fees without removing the fees from statute. As I mentioned at our last hearing, we submitted two draft concepts to the Department of Administrative Services early last year. Our thought was to give you, the Legislative Assembly, the choice in how to address our revenue situation. We were told, however, that we could only proceed with one of those bills, and we chose to move forward with a bill to remove the fees from statute. We come before you today interested only in addressing our revenue situation at this time, and we are comfortable whichever version of this bill you decide to proceed with. And once again, we respectfully request.
Hard for you to say, huh?
Yeah. It's been a long week already. We respectfully request you to pass Senate Bill 279.
All right. Thank you. And I guess just for the record again, Pamela, the dollar amounts that are in the dash one amendments correspond to the figures in your budget that's already been approved by Ways and Means and is out on the floor. Is that right?
Chair Shetterly, members of the committee, yes, that is correct.
Okay. All right. Mr. Zielinski and, oh, go ahead, let's go ahead with.
Chair Shetterly, I don't have anything to say right at this time.
That's fine. Thank you. And I'm sorry, ma'am, you.
This is Karen Winters. I'm a chairperson of the Board of Tax Service Examiners. And at this point, I also don't have anything to add to the testimony of Ms. Constantopoulos. Just here for questions and answers if you want.
Any questions of these three witnesses?
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative.
Pam, are you advocating for the amendments or just you presented them as something, would you prefer the bill as is, as was passed by the Senate? Would you prefer that over the amended version at this point?
Representative Beck, Chair Shetterly, that's an interesting question. I'm actually neutral on either version, as long as our revenue situation is taken care of.
I asked that the Dash 1 amendments be prepared after the last meeting. It seemed to me that with the budget notes that accompanied the budget out of Ways and Means, that this session might not be the session to go to rule authority, but rather to go to statutory authority and then let the board respond to the budget notes in the 2003 session and readdress, I think, the issue of the fee question then. This seems to me to be a consistent approach with what Ways and Means has taken on the budget as reflected in the budget notes. That was my thinking. Anybody else for these witnesses? Okay. Thank you very much. Jason Williams.
Chair Shetterly, members of the committee, my name is Jason Williams, Executive Director of the Taxpayer Association. I'll just be real brief. I just came down here, saw the amendments. They look fantastic. For us, the big acid test is thinking about, with 25 fee increases, this proposed fee increases this session, how many of those are going to get through the process by the end of the day? And I'm thinking, well, maybe about half. If those 25 fee increases were all proposed by the agencies themselves and they got to do that, how many would have been already increased? Probably the whole 25. And it is having your guys' judgment, the people who elected you guys being in that process, which we think makes it the most fair and most correct. So just encourage you to support those amendments and to pass out the Senate Bill 279. Thank you.
As amended.
As amended.
All right. Anybody else wish to be heard on Senate Bill 279? And in that case, I will close the public hearing and open a work session.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Witt.
I move the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 279.
Thank you very much. Representative Witt moves the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 279. Is there any discussion, any objection to the motion? If not, so ordered.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Witt.
I move Senate Bill 279 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Witt moves Senate Bill 279 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion on that motion? If not, please call the roll.
Representative Bay.
Excused.
Bass.
Aye.
Brown.
Aye.
Cash.
Aye.
Williams.
Excused.
Rhea.
Aye.
Vice Chair Carlson.
Aye.
Safari.
Aye.
Chair
Shatterly. Aye. House Bill 279, as amended, goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Anybody wish to carry this?
We can give that to Representative Pelley.
Well, he's carrying their budget. He's got their budget. Is there a volunteer?
I'll take it.
Okay. Representative Witt, thank you very much. That concludes. Yes.
I just want to pass along that maybe this would be a time to move that bill against the marriage penalty, because I think we have unanimity now on the committee.
Oh, that's right, because we have our one single member on his way to join the that exclusive club.
Yeah.
Congratulations. Okay, that concludes our work on.
Chairman, I heard he did it for the tax benefits that he perceived. After our bill comes off.
Yeah. I wonder if OTIM could have predicted that.
That's pretty
funny. I want names. Okay, let's go to Senate Bill 301. I'll open a, let's see, do we have any amendments on this?
Mr. Chair, there are no amendments on Senate Bill 301.
Okay. Let me see. I guess, let me just take a look out in the room here. We had a public hearing on this. I see a lot of the same folks signed up to testify today. With no amendments, I'd be just about as much inclined to go right into work session on this unless somebody really wants to get up and talk about this. Okay. If we need any explanation or clarification of the issues when we get to this, I'll raise your hand and we'll bring you up. But like I say, with no amendments, I'd be just as inclined, I think, to go right into work session. So let me do that. We will go into work session on Senate Bill 301. Now, Paul.
Mr. Chair, what the bill does is expand the regulatory authority of the State Board of Tax Service Examiners and changes the name of the State Board of Tax Practitioners. It increases maximum penalty for violations. It was amended in the Senate to deal with investigations as to when those investigations are made public. And essentially what the amendment does, we give the board discretion over that as to when that information would be public. One issue that you had raised in a note to me following the meeting was if the board itself conducts hearings, and the answer is no, the board doesn't. It goes through the central panel.
So no amendment was necessary on that score. Okay, any comments or questions by the committee?
One quick question.
Representative Hess.
The fine was lowered. $10,000 to $5,000 on the amendment. Reduce the maximum civil fine per violation from 10 to 5. I was just curious.
It was in the Senate.
And Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Representative.
I think the maximum fine was $1,000. I think in the is currently $1,000.
Mm-hmm.
I think in the bill it upped it to $10,000. But I think the Senate amendment lowered it to $5,000.
That's what I was trying to find.
That's correct, Representative. That was voted on in the Senate, and actually. The Senate had looked at it at the $10,000 and asked for an amendment to go that high. And the $5,000 was the original amendment recommended by the board itself.
Looking at this, there were no votes in the Senate, and nobody testified or signed up to testify against this bill either when we first heard it or today. So.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Kifuri.
I move Senate Bill 301A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Kifuri moves Senate Bill 301A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative, is there any further discussion?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Witt.
I would frankly appreciate your opinion on something in the bill.
Yeah.
Specifically, if you go to page 3, this is in section 3, and it is on... paragraph 6, where it specifically says, if the board has reason to believe that a person has been engaged in, is engaging in, or is about to engage in any violation or any rule adopted thereunder, then the board may assess a civil penalty. Does that language cause any concern for you, about to engage in?
Thanks for the question. I hadn't given that particular thought. I don't think so. I mean, that's the basis on which either an injunction would stand already anyway in a regular court action. If a court were to determine that a party is about to engage in some activity. I don't know, Pam, do you want to address that?
Mr. Chairman,
yeah,
I can see that for the
mm-hmm.
process
mm-hmm.
portion. I
mm-hmm.
guess that would make sense.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that it makes sense for a civil penalty for something that you might be about to engage in the judgment of the board.
Come on up.
Chair Shetterly, members of the committee, once again for the record, I'm Pamela Constantopoulos, Director of the State Board of Tax Service Examiners. In answer to your question, about to engage in would fall only in the case of a cease and desist order. We could not assess civil penalties on an action that has not occurred. So cease and desist, for instance, or about to engage in, for instance, a person has advertised, and we hear many times, well, I haven't done a single return. Well, you're advertising that you're going to do returns, and so that would be the instance.
Even though that's all in one sentence, it's your statement that the language about to engage in a violation is language that would relate back to the cease and desist order and not to an imposition of a penalty?
Chair Shetterly, yes, that's correct.
What's your thought?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I appreciate the testimony.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that's what the language says, though. It uses the word and to assess civil penalties. And I appreciate maybe that's all the board would do, but it seems to give them language to assess a civil penalty based upon someone about to engage in a practice that's a violation of the statute or a rule.
Chair Shetterly, I did not bring my attorney today.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And I would like to have him at this moment.
Your attorney can be appointed to represent you if you do not have the funds.
Chair Shetterly, this was this was the recommended language.
It's a very uncomfortable thing.
Yeah, right. Well, what's your opinion? Well, we have, okay, let's parse this. In the on lines 20 and 21, we have the cease and desist from any violation or threatened violation. So I guess, you know, and this is dangerous territory. We've done it before, and we made it. It seems to me that covers that that issue of about to engage, because it's saying either from a violation or threatened violation of those statutes, which are the same three statutes as appear on line 23. And so, do you have the bill in front of you?
No, but I know the portion that...
Okay, I guess my thinking is if we were to make a conceptual amendment, this is just run this by the committee, we could delete the language on line 23, or is about
right.
to engage. And there you've limited then that potential violation remedy to a cease and desist order and not the imposition of a penalty. And I think that addresses Representative Witt's concern and is consistent with what you said the intent of the board was.
Mr. Chairman, I think you have to put the word or in. Remove the comma on line 23
yeah.
to engage.
Mm-hmm.
Put the word or in, or is engaged in any violation. And then drop out the words or is about to engage. Delete those words. Let me go through that again.
Yeah,
Chairman.
Please do. I think I'm...
All right, on line 23,
right.
words would be engaged, and then you put in the word or.
Mm-hmm. You delete the comma.
Mm-hmm.
Right, delete the comma, put in the word or. Engaged or is engaging.
Mm-hmm.
Then you get rid of the words, delete the words or is about to engage.
Right.
So you jump, and so it would read engaged or is engaging in any violation.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense to me. Yeah, Representative Beck.
Not knowing much about this kind of stuff, but if someone is advertising that they are going, they're hoping to prepare people's tax forms or taxes, and the tax examiners, practitioners, have reason to believe based on either past history or statements that the tax preparer has made to a customer that they're going to do something unlawful, is it the tax examiner's board's desire to be able to slap a penalty on someone who they have pretty strong reason to believe is about to engage in an illegal act?
Chair Shetterly, Representative Beck, we would like to be proactive in our ability to stop illegal activities as early as we find out about them, even if it be merely at advertising. The cease and desist order, as it stands, applies to unlicensed activities. We would not be able to issue, for instance, a cease and desist in an advertising situation.
Mm-hmm.
So my personal feeling is that we would like to retain the ability to proactively address any situation before consumers are harmed.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
What if you have a situation where before the tax season someone unlicensed is advertising to charge a fee to perform some of these services, and you know that to be something unlawful, and you know that he's about to be engaged in doing this unlawful activity?
Chair Shetterly, Representative Huss, in that situation, we could certainly assess a civil penalty for the advertising because that is a violation. Mm-hmm. However, we could not issue a cease and desist until a return was actually prepared.
You mean you couldn't issue a cease and desist or a penalty?
If that word is, or if that phrase is about to engage in,
well,
was
no,
removed.
No, because on line 21, you have threatened violation, and that relates to cease and desist. You can direct a person to cease and desist from any violation or threatened violation of those same three statutes.
And the condition of that phrase would be if the board has reason to believe that a person has been engaged, is engaging, or is about to engage, and is about to engage would be in exactly this advertising situation where we believe that the person is about to engage. If we remove that clause, I think we would have difficulty making a cease and desist order stand.
Representative Carlson.
Well, Mr. Chair, mm-hmm. just let me try to... I thought that we were splitting the two issues, mm-hmm. before the comma and after the comma. So I guess in your prior testimony, did you state that you would actually assess a civil penalty on someone who is about to do this, or we would do a cease and desist order?
This... Chair Shetterly.
Before the comma is about cease and desist orders. Mm-hmm. After the comma is about assessing civil penalties.
Chair Shetterly, Representative Carlson, that whole paragraph refers to cease and desist order and when we can issue a cease and desist. The cease and desist is only in cases where we have reason to believe that the person is about to engage, as it's written right now. Mm-hmm. Yes, we could issue civil penalties, but we could not issue a cease and desist order in an instance where a return was not prepared.
Okay. Tell you what, it's a Senate bill. We've got lots of time for Senate bills. Let's ask Elsie to take a look at this. I think the idea is we want to make sure it says what we're all saying, and that is that you have a cease and desist to stop a person from a violation or from violating if they're about to violate. Then you have the imposition of a penalty to address an actual violation of the statute of rules.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I'm having a little trouble understanding the testimony because it says you can issue a cease and desist, mm-hmm. based upon a threatened violation.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
I just have a hard time giving an agency the right to assess a civil penalty,
right.
for something someone is quote-unquote planning on doing.
Yeah.
That's a little scary to me.
I think the testimony is that's not the intent, but... It certainly raises that as a lack of clarity in the statute anyway, I think, in the way it's drafted.
Mr. Chair, legislative counsel is here. If you want me to ask.
Dexter, come on up. When he heard conceptual amendment, I'm sure he turned up.
Mr. Chair, members, I'm sure you've done the right thing. I think if, at a minimum, an additional comma is needed after penalties on line 22 to ensure that the last part of this paragraph ties back to the cease and desist order, and there may, in fact, be a better... a clearer way of writing it than that.
My inclination is to give it a chance to ponder that. Like I say, it's a Senate bill. We're not in any rush to get... we got lots of time to get this back and do it right. If it was a House bill, I'd be a little bit more pressured about it. But mm-hmm. Questions or comments? You've heard the discussion, so you know where we want to go.
Right.
Okay. Let's do that. We'll take the prudent way.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Representative.
Maybe while the agency is here, if we can have some explanation as to why they believe a five-fold increase in the maximum penalty is appropriate.
Chair Shetterly, Representative Witt, as I testified before, the $1,000 civil penalty in many cases is merely a cost of doing business to some people. And I gave the example of a tax protester that was charging $3,500 per return to bring the return to zero tax. Obviously, a $1,000 civil penalty, the person's still making a fairly good profit. We want to be able to issue a civil penalty which is commensurate with the violation. And in addition, the $5,000 civil penalty would bring us in line with other boards that are now at $5,000, for instance, the Board of Accountancy. And
all right. Mister, just one more question for you. Is that your daughter?
It is.
Well, introduce her.
This is my daughter, Kate Johnson.
Katie?
Kate.
Kate. Hi, Kate. Thanks for coming down.
You're having a great spring break, Kate.
Okay. Yeah. All right, let us know when you get those amendments back, and we'll set the thing right up for hearing, and we'll take care of it. Okay, thanks, everybody.
I'm Dad.
Close the work session on Senate Bill 301. Now let's go to public hearing on... does it make sense to run these together or not?
Yes.
It does?
I think.
You tell me that? Okay. Let's do that then, since we are in public hearing for these two. Let's run public hearings concurrently for Senate Bill 520 and Senate Bill 521. I'll open the public hearing on both of those. And welcome, Ed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 520A deals with residential alternative energy incentive programs. Senate Bill 521A deals with the business energy tax credit programs. A little more specifically, Senate Bill 520A extends the sunset on the alternative energy system property tax exemption for 10 additional years. It eliminates the sunset on the energy conservation lender's income tax credit. It eliminates the sunset on the residential energy income tax credit, and it expands types of collateral accepted under the small-scale energy loan program. In addition, it makes some other substantive and technical changes to the residential alternative energy incentive programs. Senate Bill 521A, as I mentioned, affects the business energy tax credit programs. Specifically, it allows utilities to claim the business energy tax credit, whereas currently they cannot. It allows customers of consumer-owned and other public utilities to take advantage of the business energy tax credit. It expands eligibility under the credit to include credits for facilities that provide transit passes to students and patrons of medical facilities. And it provides that any entity can provide the present value of the tax credit for any eligible project. It also allows business energy tax credit to be claimed in a single year instead of spread over 5 years for small projects with eligible costs under $20,000. And it adds a couple of additional eligible practices, including car share expenses and sustainable building practices are eligible for the tax credit under Senate Bill 521A.
Okay. Mike Graney, why don't you come on up and if you want to talk about both of them.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mike Graney, I'm Assistant Director of the Oregon Office of Energy. I'm here to testify in support of both Senate Bill 520 and 521. I think Mr. Waters gave a good summary of both bills. We see these two as essential packages, or part of a package of energy bills that include two energy facility siting bills, too, that we've been working with Representative Witt and other members and other committees on, as well, to assure that Oregonians have access to stable supplies of electricity, but also have the means to help control their own usage and, in turn, then some control over the energy bills they pay. Senate Bill 520 focuses on residential incentives that sunset at the end of this year, and 520 continues those programs. We think they're important. Over 20,000 individuals have taken advantage of the tax credit program to help finance solar systems in Oregon. Another 40,000 have acquired energy-efficient appliances that save both energy and water through this program. It also provides incentives for alternative fuel vehicles. In addition, the 520 has some technical changes to help our residential programs work more effectively. 521, in turn, has some changes that we think will help the business energy tax credit work more effectively. So that program does not sunset this year, but the changes in it will help utilities work with their customers more effectively. It lets small businesses take the tax credit in 1 year that's normally taken over 5 years, and that's particularly helpful for small businesses that finance transit passes for their employees, because typically that's a relatively small purchase. And instead of having it on their books for 5 years, they can do that in 1 year. Taken together, again, Senate Bill 521 has some other technical changes, but taken together, these will help both these programs operate more effectively, and we think are an important key piece of Oregon's response to the energy situation we're in. And I guess in the interest of times, I know there are a number of other witnesses, I'd be happy to answer any questions, but stop right here if there aren't any.
Other questions for Mr. Greeny? Move ahead then. Let's bring up Steve Vincent.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You bet.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Steve Vincent with Avista Utilities. We're the natural gas utility serving the Southern Oregon region. Our utility uses both of these tax credit programs in a number of ways. Natural gas vehicles is an activity within the Southern Oregon airshed, which has been pretty important to reducing some of the problems we've had in that region. And Representative Bates probably knows all too well. I often tell a story that my parents would go to school and get to school and have to wash in the washroom, wash the soot off their hands and face because of smudge pots. And fortunately, we don't have air quality that's that poor any longer, but our folks in the region still recognize that we do have an air inversion problem. And natural gas vehicles has been one area to resolve that. Appliances, dishwashers and washers and dryers and those kinds of things that qualify for the residential energy tax credit. So they conserve on electricity. They also conserve water. And when you conserve water, it doesn't matter what heats the water here, whether it's natural gas or electricity, it's conservation. I do want to make one point about the issue with projects of $20,000 or less qualifying. We do have residential and business customers who would implement a measure or buy an appliance who won't do it because the 5 years is simply too long. If you spent $1,000 on a project, 5 years just doesn't seem to make sense to some of our customers. So in a conversation I had with a gentleman in our company who heads conservation, he said that would make a considerable difference in our ability to convince our consumers to implement certain measures, whether it's a dishwasher or other projects. The dishwasher, though, applies to residential, not business. There are some businesses, though, who are looking and considering some smaller projects that this change will make a significant difference. The one thing that, considering your time here, the one thing I just really want to point out is that both of these programs are well administered by the Oregon Office of Energy. I know that you hear other folks come before your committee and as well as other committees talking about state agencies, but we've worked with the Oregon Office of Energy for a number of years now, and I believe, as do many of the employees within our utility, believe the agency's responsiveness to applicants and their customer-friendly demeanor makes it seem as though they are working toward establishing long-term relationships with each consumer rather than serving a bureaucracy role. They really do go out of their way to be flexible in administering these programs where they can be outside the confines of the statutes or administrative rules. The one last thing I'll just point out, I handed you a brochure, set of brochures on fuel cells. Avista Corp has a subsidiary, Avista Labs, it's a separate wholly owned subsidiary developing a modular fuel cell for small commercial and residential use. Both of these tax credit programs cover those fuel cells as they do other types of fuel cells. Extending the property tax exemption to fuel cells, in my mind, simply broadens the public policy that when it was originally passed, probably never considered fuel cells. So I just believe that this is a step toward causing statute to come current with technology that's out there, because in some ways we are a competing alternative energy device to solar. But then at the same time, you'll see fuel cells that use solar photovoltaics at the same time in remote sites. So any questions, be happy to answer them. Thanks.
Question is for Mr. Vincent.
Yes.
Who's that?
Oh,
really? Quite good on these bills. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Tom O'Connor. Oh, got you all scared. Eat you alive up here. While he's getting ready, actually, Representative Witt, you've got a couple of companion bills. You want to just kind of set the context for us?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll do that. There's actually a series of five bills that members of both the Senate and the House and the Governor's Office and the Department of Energy have been working on for the last 6 to 8 weeks. To deal with the energy crisis that we have in the western United States. Two of the bills have to do primarily with siting provisions relative to power plants in Oregon. One bill has already cleared the Senate. It's come to the House. The other bill is starting in the House. Both those bills are in the Commerce Committee of the House. These two bills, of course, which have passed the Senate, deal with the conservation side of it. What we're trying to do through these bills is we're trying to address issues relative to supply so that we can increase more supply as quickly as possible, and also to address issues of demand through these conservation pieces, which are designed to promote alternative uses of energy and promote energy conservation through a variety of measures. The fifth bill is our low-income bill payment assistance piece, which passed the House about 2 months ago and is currently over in the Senate. That was House Bill 2075. So these two bills are, I guess, the conservation pieces in an overall strategy that has been being worked on now for 2 months to try to address both supply and demand issues relative to energy, particularly as it will apply over the next 1 to 2 years.
Good. Thank you. Tom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With your permission, Cindy Finlayson from PG, of course, came up.
What is her name down?
We thought maybe we could illustrate that these were important to both the customers of small utilities and large utilities. Oregon Municipal Electric Utilities is very much in favor of Senate Bill 520 and 521. These tax credits can be used by or are used by our folks in combination with our own utility incentive programs, in our case through the Bonneville Power Administration, and also with our own utility level incentives. we make use of both, or our customers make use of both the residential tax credits and the business and energy tax credits. A very important feature for us of Senate Bill 521 of the business energy tax credit is a clarification that ensures that customers of consumer-owned utilities, nonprofit utilities, can use these tax credits through a pass-through mechanism. And so that while we as nonprofit entities can't take the tax credit, obviously, through this program in partnership with our business customers, the Department of Energy, we're able to do some things like in the case of the City of Ashland, which was a pilot project that the department really helped out on. There was a package that was put together with the Ashland Municipal Utility contribution, money from the Bonneville Power Administration, Avista Utilities, which helped out and purchased the tax credit, and then the ratepayers of the community as well. And as part of that, the city is in the process of installing solar voltaic systems on businesses and homes I believe the federal post office. So it's we think these are two very good bills. They're the kinds of things that that our customers can really use at this time, and we urge your a due pass recommendation. Thank you.
Questions for Tom? Cindy.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Cindy Finlayce, and I represent Portland General Electric. Thank you for allowing me to tag on with Mr. O'Connor. Again, as Representative Witt said, that these particular bills, Senate Bill 520 and 521, are part of a package, and we think that the most important part of the package to alleviate the energy crisis in the Northwest and alleviate the supply issue is both adding additional supply and more conservation and more focus on conservation in Oregon. So we as a company have used these programs before. We know they work. Our customers use them. And we urge that you pass and support these bills, and we certainly do. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions from Ms. Finlayson? Boy. All right.
Thank you
very much.
You.
We have one more. Bernie Bottomley from TriMet. Bernie, come on forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Bernie Bottomley with the Government Affairs Department at TriMet, and here to support Senate Bill 521 on behalf of TriMet and the Oregon Transit Association. We're primarily interested in the transit pass subsidy portion of the bill. Allows an employer who subsidizes transit passes or other commute options for their employees to take a portion of the cost as a tax credit. It's proven to be a very effective tool in the Portland metropolitan area. And working with businesses, we have about 360 employers in the metropolitan area representing about 71,000 employees that receive some form of subsidized transit pass or carpool or vanpool benefit. And one of the ways that we work with them to find solutions for their commute options is with the tax credit. We definitely support the ability to take the credit in 1 year. A lot of these businesses are relatively small, and they don't have the accounting infrastructure to take care of keeping track of this credit over a five-year period. And in as much as they spend the money in 1 year, it's somewhat different than a capital investment. We think it's worthwhile for them to be able to take the credit in 1 year. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions for Mr. Bottomley? All right, thank you. I think it's good, and probably the reason that you're not seeing a lot of questions here from the committee is the receptiveness on the part of the committee to do this. I think we're looking at some energy storm clouds gathering to the south of us here in California, and the pretty felt need that we have here to have some policies in place and to continue some policies to to be prepared, I guess, to weather that storm. And these seem to me to be parts of what we are going to need to do that. For the benefit of folks who are attending this meeting, and for members too, I'll just reiterate what we've talked about before. And the reason we are not moving this these bills to work session today, this is just part of the agreement that we have between the House and Senate revenue chairs, that bills that have revenue impact we're going to hold until we get further into the session to balance against Ways and Means and all the other fiscal issues that will come up to the end of the session. We are pinching pennies here, and I note that the revenue impact on Senate Bill 520, we have $2.42 million in the 0103. It's less than that on Senate Bill 521. It's $1.103. In other sessions, I think that would have been almost regarded as de minimis, but my hope and expectation is that we will see these bills back probably in May for work session. I feel very confident about these bills, but we have an agreement between the Senate and the House that I want Senator Ferrioli to adhere to, and so I'm going to adhere to on this side, and that is to keep these bills until we are able to balance them against everything else that comes up at end of session. Representative Witt.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think a portion of both of these bills are contemplated in the governor's budget. Isn't that correct?
I know that 521, I think, no, 520, Ed, you can help me, but it seems to me, there's a note there that of that, $1.8 million was anticipated in the governor's budget. And 521, what do we have there, Ed?
Mr. Chair, Representative Webb, members of the committee, governor allocated $1.8 million for provisions in Senate Bill 520A affecting the alternative energy incentive program extensions. We've estimated that the impact in 0103 is a bit more than that, $2.42 million, based on some additional data, and that the bill affects more provisions than simply extending or eliminating some of the sunsets. 521A has an estimated revenue impact of $1.1 million. None of that is anticipated in the governor's current budget.
Representative Carlson.
No, Mr. Chair, that was my question, to understand the assumptions and the revenue impact here.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Beck.
I know the House has passed out a couple of tax credit bills. I wonder if staff could, as these come up, we could kind of keep a running tab so that we kind of know what we've passed out, what the Senate has passed, any given. It'd be helpful for me just to know
what we're balancing at the end.
Well, yeah, just so it doesn't all surprise us one day
in
May, just so that we can be mulling it over. And I assume the Senate is not moving any of the bills we've passed, the reforestation tax credit.
Right.
Yeah, that would be nice to see.
Pardon?
We have it passed.
Yeah, right. Oh, you do. I mean, okay.
Yeah, that'd be great. Let's have it as we accumulate bills out of here and out of the Senate at any given time.
Sure. Let's make a copy of that available to committee members.
Mr. Chair, does the tab have the property tax impact as well as the general fund income tax impact?
Ed, do you know? Paul? The question was, does it has both general fund and property tax impact? On schools.
Well,
it doesn't have.
I would be interested in counties as well, if it's possible to do that.
I did ask Elizabeth, if you recall, last week on, I think it was the personal property tax, the $20,000, the increase in the exemption amount, to give us a mapping of some of our other property tax bills, so we can just ask her to expand that. Let's do that, too. That's fine. A little information is good. Representative Bates.
Just a quick question to staff. We expect or we may well see some significant increases in energy costs in the next 12 to 18 months with all the factors involved, gas and lack of rain and possible California effect.
Excuse me, lack of what?
We're still praying for more.
Yeah.
Has that been factored into these bills as far as financial impact, and that people might start applying for more of these and asking for more of these as they see their personal bills rise?
Representative Bates, members of the committee, that's a very good question. We have been anticipated a rate of growth, which is sort of consistent with historical patterns. I tended to err on the upside a little bit because of the point that you raised. If energy rates really go outside of the range we're accustomed to seeing them, then all bets could be off. These programs could become a lot more attractive to individual residential owners and businesses. Maybe a question for Mike, if I may.
Sure.
Are there some limits on certification, or does the your office have power to limit certifications in cases where the applications are running much higher than anticipated or higher than historical?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Waters, not on that basis. There's criteria that I suppose, for example, require paybacks in the business tax credit of at least 1 year. So if things are too cost effective, they don't qualify for the tax credit. So if we see a huge rise in energy costs, that could actually make some measures ineligible that are very inexpensive and very cheap and pay back very quickly. And I guess, too, while it's hard to know how people would react to prices, the tax credit still requires an out-of-pocket investment that at least some consumers might have difficulty doing when they're dealing with very high prices as well. So it's really hard to quantify or predict how much demand we would have.
All right. Thank you, everybody. I think with that, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 520 and 521. And if no further business, we are adjourned.